Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this specialist series, Explore How to Plan an Expedition, a series created for the Royal Geographical Society. I'm Matt Pycroft, an expedition specialist, filmmaker and photographer, and I've been going on expeditions under various banners for 15 years. I also sit on the council of the RGS. Episode 13 focuses on an often overlooked part of expeditions, coming home. In this episode, I chat to Dr. Sophie Redlin about the importance of decompression as you transition back from your expedition to everyday life, how to re-engage when you get home, and how to find and give support. We also discuss how to answer the how was your trip question. Finally, if you're looking for support with planning your own expedition or field research project, then head to rgs.org to begin the journey. Right, let's get started with episode 13 of How to Plan an Expedition. Please, can you start at the start by introducing yourself? Tell me who you are and what you do.
Yep. Hello, I'm Sophie Redlin. I'm a GP, sort of first and foremost, also an expedition doctor, also anthropologist studying medical anthropology with an interest in mental health in different cultures. And I'm particularly interested in expedition mental health and keeping ourselves emotionally safe in the wilderness.
Brilliant. So definitely qualified to comment on coming home and how to do it.
I hope so.
And what is your experience, kind of brief overview of expeditions?
So I've done a number of expeditions as a doctor, also as a participant. I did my first expedition at 17, crossing the States on horseback and kayak, and was so taken by that experience that it inspired me to enable others to do the same. So I've done quite a few expeditions with young people, so British Exploring Society stuff, and then a few tall ship sailing expeditions, which can throw you into some weird situations. And through those trips, I've actually started delivering teaching around expedition mental health to both young people and leaders as well.
Amazing. So as I've told you, I'm very excited about this episode because it's something that I don't think is talked about enough in the worlds that we move in. Scotty Johnson put it really well when he corrected me, because I was saying that expeditions are split 50-50 into planning and doing, and most people focus on the doing. And he said that it's actually split into thirds. It's the planning, it's the doing, and then it's the post-processing, whether that's outreach or whether that's personal. And it's something that I think we all think about, those of us who go on these trips, but it's not something we talk about a lot. Why do you think that is?
Firstly, I totally agree with that. I think there are phases to every journey. And you're right that there's not a lot of community around that coming home section and sometimes the planning section as well. I think the reason is that, probably many, partly it's because we're very focused on the excitement and the action of being out there and doing things. That's when people are following you online, you know, etc. And I think, therefore, when you come home, it's sort of being spat out the other end of the treadmill almost, and there's less just general excitement around it. But also, I think often the expectation from others is that you've had an amazing time and you'll still be living off this kind of high and giving your talks and writing your books, when actually, as you probably know, like me, it can be a really low time of feeling disorientated and isolated because no one's around you anymore who understands what it was like being on that ship for 6 weeks. So I think, yeah, those are the reasons. And I've heard multiple times recently of people doing much longer kind of deployments with various organizations, and there's really not that kind of decompression or community. And I think that's a great shame.
Yeah, that word decompression is the exact word I use. So just, you know, not to do too many personal anecdotes, but I do struggle with it, I think, more than some of my friends and peers. And I just call it the decompression chamber. Now that I'm 15 years in, it's something I know to be true of myself. So I allow myself that space and that time. I still have to be a dad and a husband and do my job, etc. But I'm allowed to be almost like doing a bit of self-therapy. Do you think it's normal to acknowledge the need to do it, or do we just kind of struggle our way back in? And whether or not other people are knowing that it's happening to us, do we actually know it's happening to us?
I think you know what I'm going to say to that. we should absolutely acknowledge that it's a thing. Much of the narratives around mental health generally are changing, but that's taking the acknowledgement of these things. And so, you know, this idea that we struggle on just for me continues this quite kind of toxic narrative of, you know, you've got to keep going, you can't ask for help, etc., which isn't good for anyone, because then people going on to the next expedition and then going with the pressure of they have to be fine when they come back. So I think what we don't need to do is what I would call pathologize it. So, you know, sort of say if 2 weeks later you're still feeling down, there's something wrong with you. But we need to make it okay for people to talk about. And I think encourage spaces, encourage those communities that we were saying, where perhaps, you know, it's an important part of an expedition that your team get together 4 weeks down the line and just chat about how it was. It doesn't need to be a medical thing or a big deal. It just needs to be an acceptance that that journey isn't over for you. And actually, that's kind of great. It's great that these memories stay with us. And often for me, the reason expeditions are so impactful is because they were challenging as well as, you know, the high moments. And so I think that is often why they need decompression, right? It's not just a jolly, it's something that changes you, that transforms you in some way. And speaking to people who resonate with that, I think, is really important. I think that's why people love Explore, because we all get it a little bit, you know.
But how do you feel about the language around it? Because I think I'm really conscious of not just talking about the negatives in this conversation. And I wonder, I once did a podcast with an ex-Special Forces guy, Jay Morton, and I was talking to him about PTSD from a very naive standpoint. And he was saying, well, no, I've never experienced it, but I have experienced profound PTG. You know, post-traumatic growth. And I just think it's worth us talking about and acknowledging that actually, largely, expeditions are intensely positive experiences. And is there power to be found in the decompression in a positive sense of understanding and learning what we've experienced and processing it and using it to move forwards?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's sort of what I meant when I touched on, we don't want to overly pathologize it as, you know, it's some kind of mental illness, but you can seek help for it. It should be, as I say, something that's accepted as part of the human journey. But as you say, from that comes the growth of communities, the personal growth, hugely from expeditions, from being in the wilderness. But what I always say is that you need to feel emotionally safe and held in order to experience that growth, is what I would say. I mean, there are organic positives that come from being up a mountain, but you can really optimize that if people feel able to engage with the experience. In terms of actually post-traumatic growth, another bit of work that I'm doing at the moment is around moral injury in ex-military and healthcare workers. And the actual kind of response that we're using, which is all about talking and sharing, is very much based on that concept of post-traumatic growth, that, as you say, great things can come from struggle if people are supported in the right way, I would say.
I think it might be quite useful for us to kind of go through a little mini list of like the reasons people struggle to come home in overview and kind of explore each one in detail, if you're happy to, and start with whatever you choose.
Sure. So I think the first and sort of obvious thing is that, and again, you'll know from your own experiences, you're placed in such a different environment, which, again, drawing on the positives, can be really beneficial. So you're away from things like social media, often those anxieties related to that. You're away potentially from difficult work situations, difficult home life, etc. And you're in this sort of bubble. So the bubble literally bursts when you get put back into normal life. And I've heard people struggle with, you know, things like hearing traffic noise again. And the second point to that, I suppose, is that because you can experience these profound sort of transformations, for me, it was most markedly in Antarctica when I was just so struck by the emptiness, by the sort of lack of human touch, that when I got back to, you know, the real world, as it were, you're hit by the sense of, you know, what we're doing to the world, capitalism, all the rest of it. And I think genuinely that can be a really difficult journey for a human being, as it should be. You know, we should be challenged in these ways. Unfortunately, not everyone is able to access Antarctica, etc. Again, it can feel very isolating because you feel like you've been touched and had this experience. And yet, how do you explain that to your family? So without being grandiose. It's almost a bit like coming back from the war, isn't it? You've had this like amazing experience and challenging experience, but how do you relay that in a set of 20 photos to your grandmother in a slideshow? So I think that real dissonance between what you've experienced and what the sort of general public know can be difficult.
So how do we combat that?
Again, I would say a lot of it is about community. It's about maintaining the contacts with people who were there. But also, I think there's a bit of acceptance involved that, you know, you don't need to be able to explain exactly how you felt to people for your experience to be validated, right? It can be a very personal thing. I found weirdly when I got back from Antarctica, and I was only there, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, I almost didn't want to share a lot about it. You know, I wanted it to be mine. And I think that can be a really beautiful thing as well. And there's a lot of pressure, isn't there, these days to, you know, but where's your film? You know, where's your, you know, how are you going to like access your audience? And actually, does that maybe take away a bit from the journey you've been on yourself? So I think just, yeah, remembering that it's kind of okay and kind of cool in a way that only I get this. But then 4 weeks down the line, I'm meeting my buddies who were there with me over a beer and remembering what we felt, you know, and remembering that we had that moment of seeing an iceberg and realizing they're disappearing, etc. So I think it's a combination of those two things, I would say.
That's really interesting. And you're very welcome to kind of dissect and use me as a case study if you want. But I'm actually at the point where I don't like talking about them after the fact. I suspect that that's some kind of learned behavior of not feeling satisfied by those conversations. So obviously I make films, I make podcasts, I take photos, and people can see those and watch those. When somebody says, how was it? I say, oh yeah, it was really hard, but it was brilliant. And that's kind of the end of the conversation. I'm done. Is that okay? That's enough for me, or is that a problem?
Well, without being your therapist, I'd say it's interesting you're asking that question. I think it's totally okay. What's okay for you, right? People are going to be different in that. But yeah, I can resonate with, and not in a critical way, but that dissatisfaction of talking to people because you want people to get it. I found it on the few occasions I've worked in developing countries as a doctor. You come back and people want a certain account of that story. And if you can't give it, it feels very destabilizing and strange. So I think, yeah, maintaining your, without wanting to use the word boundaries, maintaining your boundaries as to what I felt is my authentic experience and I don't need to share all of that is important, yeah.
And how much do you think that sense of loss plays into all of this around kind of, you know, do people genuinely struggle with this sense of loss of the camaraderie, the wilderness, the experience, the simplicity? And how do we cope with that?
I'm sure they do. I'm sure that's a factor. And I think, as I said at the very beginning, if on expedition or working remotely or whatever, you're certainly placed in an environment usually that's different, a different type of community dynamic. And as you say, in many ways, that perhaps makes connecting easier. Sometimes it doesn't. I mean, it's all very well until you get stuck in a team that you don't get on with, and then it's a different story, isn't it? But I agree with you, that idea of, well, how do we, I think it's very important to listen to yourself in those moments and think, what is it that I'm taking from this and what can I bring into everyday life? And actually a lot of the work I do around mental health on expedition has the kind of hidden agenda of these tools can be used, you know, in our everyday lives as well when we think about coping with challenges, stress. Because as you say, there are highs and lows in every day, in every part of our life. I think there's also a conversation around the reason that people do extreme travel and extreme activities. And I've always been interested about that. And I know some people in the industry would argue that sometimes people are potentially trying to escape something else or running away or running towards something or... Maybe that's true. I don't think you can generalize that for everybody at all. But I suppose in answer to your question, maybe there's, for people working through those kind of issues, there's a sense of coming back to something that needs to be processed as well. So I think my answer would always be to look inward in terms of that and think, well, how do I bring those two worlds together?
But I think for lots of people, they just love those experiences because of the places they see, the things that they find, the people they meet, and what it does to them. But I think I'm interested, you know, in kind of your professional perspective on why it's so difficult to reemerge and reengage. I suppose half of this is, you know, kind of live therapy, if you like, from where I'm sitting, as somebody who does it, but doesn't necessarily understand the things I'm feeling or experiencing. And I need to phrase this right. You know, sometimes I think a lot of people that I know feel like we're in love with two things which are completely incompatible. Rather than running away from something, I'm running towards something. Actually, it's just kind of like, home is great. I love being at home. I love everything about it. But I also love being in wild spaces with people who think and feel the same things in those places as me. Why can't we just bolt those two things onto each other back to back? Why do we need that decompression period? And what is it we're experiencing in that window, whether it's 3 days or 3 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I suppose the aim is to try and integrate that. I wonder, I don't know, it made me think of a few things. The first thing that came into my head was, I suppose, the identity that people attach to that. So who am I without those extreme travels or journeys? And I've certainly seen that in a lot of people that I've met in this walk of life. And I think that is quite difficult, because if someone thinks less of themselves without that, it then becomes, as you say, well, I have to be at home, but that's not enough for me, and therefore I need to do these extra things, and they become quite different. I think something else that's more obvious is when you mention things like camaraderie, etc. I would say, without getting too deep and depressing, but there are gaps in our society generally. That, yes, people probably fill in by doing these experiences in the same way that people who join the army find a sense of camaraderie and then at the other end of it really struggle. I mean, it's not dissimilar. And often you're in that team in really harsh, extreme environments. You know, no one's looking at it with rose-tinted glasses. But as human beings, we're, in the words of Brené Brown, we're wired for connection with other people. And so, you know... To me, it's not surprising that, for example, a young person might go on an expedition without their phone for a couple of months, feel intensely connected, and then get back. They're maybe at school, they don't have a lot of friends, they're on the phone all the time. It's pretty obvious to me why someone would really make a comparison between those two worlds and say, well, I want this. And I think the real question we have to ask ourselves is, we need to look at our society and the way we live. And, you know, you're never going to... I think replicate the excitement of summiting a mountain with four others with the office commute every day. But as you say, look at what your core values are, and are you aligning with them as much as possible in all areas of your life? And I do think that's possible. I don't think it has to be one or the other.
No, maybe it's just, you know, maybe perhaps part of the decompression is working out what makes those experiences special. But bringing it back to being, you know, inverted commas, the real world, because some of the closest relationships I have outside of my immediate family were forged on expeditions with people I've spent a relatively short amount of time with. I mean, I use one example because he won't mind me doing it. Waldo Etherington, who's one of the best kind of riggers and tree climbers in the world. I've probably spent a total of 3 months with him over 10 years, but he's one of my best friends. And I think the relationships we forge in those environments, I don't want to like stereotype and say they're so much deeper generally, but for me, they absolutely are. And I think part of that is the experience we've shared together, like, you know, looking at the sunset from a portal edge, struggling through a slime forest with 30 kilos on my back and sharing the intensity of that, whether it's difficulty or profound joy. But also I think what you're saying kind of resonates as well on the space to have conversation. Yeah, you know, we're not just in our tents on our own. You know, when we're sat on that portal ledge at night with a little sneaky nip of whiskey, we talk about things. We talk about our relationships. We talk about our families. We talk about our insecurities. We talk about our fears. And why do you think we do that more in those wild spaces than we do at home?
I mean, this is my absolute core interest. How can we get better at talking to each other? I think... you're away from other distractions. You're not busy in the same way that it's very easy to busy yourself in everyday life. You're often having experiences that I think are quite just raw as human beings. You know, you go down a river, it's really scary. You have an adrenaline surge. It's very bodily as well. When you're, you know, embodying a scary experience or a really awe-inspiring experience, I think that does forge connection, and you, the pathway then to those more meaningful conversations is there. Whereas, you know, on the tube every day, to be fair, it's not, it's very easy to be apart from that. And I suppose a sense of trust, I mean, as I say, unless you don't get on with people, you're often putting your life in people's hands. And I think that builds connection sometimes more than other things. But I'd say one of the biggest barriers to having those conversations in everyday life is fear, really. I think fear of connection, fear of saying the wrong thing, of really asking how someone is. And as I say, when you're busy, it's so easy just to not have it. But you're on a portal edge, there's just two of you. You probably couldn't go many nights without asking a personal question, I'm guessing. So, yeah, the real question is, how much do we want to have those conversations? If we want to have them, then we need to do it. We can have them.
But I wonder, again, I'm kind of just riffing on this and being the student, but how much of it is just the wilderness experience? Because can we find this really close to home? I mean, there's the ultimate cheesy line, and you're welcome to roll your eyes at me, but you know, there's that whole thing that the first university was the campfire, which I love. I've definitely found that to be true in my own experiences. And when I say, you know, I don't just mean, you know, Guyana or Wadi Rum, but also within 10 miles of home. You know, do you think it's possible to create these kinds of experiences within our kind of known world of home turf?
Yes, I do. I do. There is something about the natural environment, without a doubt. And my anthropological research is with Indigenous communities. And I would say, particularly with the communities I've worked in, this connection to the natural environment is very powerful. Their sense of belonging to that environment, to being, you know, intermingled in terms of it being a part of them, them a part of it. That has shown me the power of the environment. I think all of us in the expedition world can say, yeah, when I sit in a forest, I feel this thing that I don't feel in central London. But it's only really been through meeting these communities that I've sort of understood that more. But what I would say is, having done a lot of, for example, talking group work, where we're not sitting in a forest, we're sitting in a fairly bland room, there are other things that can nurture that connection. So I'd say, for example, while nature is one thing, human connection is another. If you get enough people talking about stuff they've found difficult, I think you can foster that space. I think as humans, we all share these sort of core values, regardless of your culture or community. And I think if you tap into that, you'll very often get people want to have, they want to share their story. They want to, you know, they want to share their experiences. And it's just whichever tool you get to do that. So if you can get a group in the forest doing that, then yeah, that's like a double whammy.
But yeah, that's kind of like a double whammy. I'm aware you probably won't want to stereotype, but do you think there's a gender thing at play here? You know, are women better at it than men, or worse? I can guess.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this the other day in terms of particularly the history of expeditions and how they were historically, you know, male dominated and still are to a certain extent, although that's changing. Being a GP and working with men and women, you know, I'd say that, yeah, I think men still, and I say this with full sympathy, are brought up to be told they need to be tough. They're not given the same permission to share emotions and feelings in the same way. And so that is our responsibility as a, again, as a society to, I think, teach young boys that doesn't have to be that way. But that requires a cultural shift.
I had the most amazing experience at the end of my last expedition, which was like nothing that has ever happened to me on expedition before. And I know what happened, I'm pretty sure. You know, I was traveling with three guys with spinal cord injuries who'd all had to be vulnerable because of their spinal cord injuries and the recovery required. And then the team that were working for and under me on the trip in terms of, you know, camera support and the camera crew, they were all younger than me and the rest of the team. And I was definitely in a kind of leadership role. When we got back, you know, we'd had the most amazing experience, kind of 3 weeks in Iceland. Before it was time to fly home, we had 3 days in Reykjavik, and we could have flown home earlier, but we decided to stay. And, you know, we had a couple of beers, not too many. It was definitely still a lucid conversation. And I just started saying a few things that I felt safe to share, which were quite personal, some insecurities, worries and concerns. And within 20 minutes, three of us were in tears. And then within an hour, with the exception of one guy out of seven, you know, everyone had been crying. Men, you know, just your classic, you know, big inverted commas with this and a grin on my face, but like your big, strong, classic, you know, men. All of us. And it was just this outpouring of honest emotion, kind of partly from the trip, but mostly all of the stuff we've been thinking about every 3 weeks of walking when there's nothing to do other than think. You know, I've had a lot of therapy in the past, and this was one of the best therapeutic experiences of my life.
Yeah, and it's so, I mean, it's heartbreaking, really, because it, again, without pathologizing, it does cause problems for people, you know, that repression and it's really interesting that you say that was more therapeutic than anything else you'd experienced, because I totally agree, having, you know, also had therapy myself, and it's wonderful, but you're right, it doesn't do the same job as sitting in a group, realizing you're not alone. And I think that's really important to say. And actually, an expedition is has such great potential for that. You know, imagine the changes that it could make to people if that's, I'm not saying we want people crying all the time, if, you know, that's uncomfortable for them. But all I mean is creating those spaces where people feel safe to do that is rare, I think.
So how do we move this forward? As an expedition community, as a society, you know, what can we do to proactively prepare for coming home? And what kind of methods can we take to ensure that we're armed?
So creating talking spaces and sort of formalized, when I say formalized, normalized, I should say, really, making them a normal part of an expedition journey. So just like we would look at a physical risk assessment or the logistics, as we said earlier, how are we looking after our well-being? And how, as you say, are we optimizing the benefits from such a trip? Because to me, it's not rocket science that getting a group together again a month after they come home could be really wonderful. And yet, as you say, it's often not the bit that's funded, right? Or the sexy bit. Or so I think it's about the training that goes in, the preparation before these expeditions. So particularly people who are new to this kind of work or trip, you know, what are they being told to expect? How are they preparing themselves? And then, yeah, creating spaces on expedition to facilitate what you've just described and afterwards as well. And as I say, that doesn't need to be in a heavy-handed, this is mental health training. I think that's one of the errors when we create this kind of binary space of like people are either normal or mentally unwell. It's just, you know, it's a really big problem, basically. It creates shame, it creates stigma. It doesn't actually move things forward. What we need to create are communities who want to talk to each other about these experiences. And that's why people flood to the Explore weekend. I've chatted to Shane about this a number of times. They want to feel that camaraderie. They want to, for one weekend, sit with other people in a room and say, yeah, that was really tough. Like, how did you manage that knot situation or whatever? So it's, for me, it's like, well, how do we make that kind of event more regular? How do we get like an online forum maybe for, I'm working with a group at the moment on building a kind of union for expedition doctors, because the guy in question who's voiced a need for that has felt really isolated in terms of, you know, being on expedition and not knowing who to turn to, et cetera. So, you know, why aren't we getting together in groups and talking about that? So I know that's all a bit vague, but I think what I'm trying to say is it's taking this stuff and making it normal and making it what everyone does and accept it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. And then, you know, what about the work you can do in and of yourself, kind of outside of a group and without the support of others? Because, you know, kind of anecdotally, that decompression period is an opportunity to cement. You know, it's almost like the analysis of what happened in the pros and the cons as a person in terms of growth. What did I do right? What did I do wrong? How do I feel? What's changed? And I think they kind of strangely actually are the most powerful moments for that reflection and how it leads to personal growth and change. But how can we do that in a way that's structured and productive rather than just kind of it being this foggy cloud of re-emerging?
Absolutely. So I think there's a lot that you can do ahead of time. And that's the stuff that I sort of teach around what do you anticipate might be difficult for yourself? And what do you do in everyday life that works for you? And how do you transplant that onto the expedition and vice versa? But then, as you say, that crucial bit of work is, and it's a bit like following, I mean, there's a lot of popular psychology stuff around at the moment around how do we process relationship breakups and learn from these things. The same thing kind of applies. You know, you come back from an expedition, you think, well, what went well for me emotionally? So you might say, for example, you know, I found myself in a situation where I was really able to share my stories with people, you know, got quite emotional. So it's then making that thought leap to what felt good about that. Other ways that I can be more vulnerable with my family, with the people around me, is that important to me? And I guess a good tool for doing that potentially is something like journaling while you're away and then really reading through that. Do you know what I mean? Coming up with maybe, I don't know, points you want to work at and go forward. I don't know that it has to be any more structured than that, really. If you want help in doing that, obviously, I think that's where a community comes in, or potentially even working one-on-one with a mentor or something. But yeah, I think, you know, personally, that's a great suggestion for anyone having that experience.
What advice would you give to somebody who is going on their first expedition? You know, I'm sure you could give lots of advice generally, but specifically around this idea of, you know, eventually you're going to come home. What could you say that would help for that inevitability, that reality?
I think the key to these things is always to think ahead. So there's a sort of narrative that if we think about what problems might happen, they'll happen. And that just isn't true when it comes to a lot of stuff around mental health. You know, we don't think up distress, or we don't think up suicidal thoughts. You know, of course, you don't want to dwell on the negative. You want to, as you said earlier, dwell on how I might be changed in a good way when I come home. But I think thinking ahead realistically to, you know, for example, say, you know, I've been away in Antarctica for a year. How am I to feel when I come back? You know, think practically around where am I going to be living? Who's going to be around me? You may need a bit of like distraction in those first few weeks. You may need time alone in those first few weeks. So have you kind of counted that in? Will it financially be a bit of a struggle when you get back? I think it's important to think of all those facets. You know, how have you left it with people when you went away? One of the hardest times for me coming home from something was when I'd ended up being away a lot longer than I'd planned. And it was really tough coming back and sort of reconnecting with people that I'd felt in a way I'd let down by being away. So I think it's, you know, as I say, not foreseeing problems, but just thinking about how can I come back, get a bit of time for myself, and then reconnect slowly. So maybe I can do a trip away with my family, or do you know what I mean? Just thinking a little bit ahead. And then we all kind of know ourselves. So if you're someone who, when you feel a bit sad, you want time by yourself, plan that in. If you're someone who, like me, likes to be around a lot of people, make sure you're around a lot of people. So as I say, I think it's about anticipating what could be an issue, planning for it, but then also just accepting that it might be completely different to what you think, and trying to accept that and be okay. And then I think, just on a slightly more serious note, having a bit of a plan in your mind. Well, if I am really struggling when I get back, is there someone that I can turn to, you know, someone like Shane in the RGS, or, you know, a bit of a mentor that might just get how I'm feeling, and perhaps I can reach out and 4 weeks down the line just plan in a chat to go through some things. So yeah, I think just thinking of strategies for yourself. And most important thing that I keep repeating, I think, is make an agreement with your team that you're going to see each other again. The number of expeditions that never do that, and it's like it never almost happened. whereas the group I went to with Antarctica still chat on WhatsApp, you know, 3 years later, and it's really important to them. So, you know, these things are okay. This is the joy of life, is building these communities and making these connections. So I think don't feel that that's the sort of weakness that you need that. See it as a strength that you want that, is what I would say.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I'm still friends with lots of people I've been away with, you know, particularly multiple times, but, you know, we've never done a kind of semi-formal reunion in 15 years.
Maybe you will now. And I was just going to add a bit more practical stuff about, I don't know if you've read the book, The Body Holds the Score, but there's so much information around and growing every day about how our sort of physical physiology is attached to our emotional well-being and how we literally store stress in our body. So I think being you know, getting a lot of sleep when you get home, eating well. Like, I know it sounds cheesy and the stuff your GP tells you and you never do, but it's really, really important. I think, again, the mistakes I've made in the past are to come home and immediately be off doing a new project. And you can probably relate to that. I think that's unwise. Speaking from experience, give your, you know, if we talk about decompression, actually give yourself some time to do nothing. And that feels really hard sometimes for people who are used to doing a lot, and you can feel like you're being lazy or you're not doing anything meaningful. But I think almost saying to yourself, no, I need, for my body's well-being, to take 2 weeks out or whatever is important. So yeah, I think then coming on to the question of should you be making decisions, it sort of relates to that. I think, again, I'm doing a lot of reading around Buddhism at the moment, and how if we're having kind of uncomfortable feelings, it's important to sort of sit with those feelings before immediately trying to act on them and make them go away. And I imagine some of the feelings people might experience on coming home are, I'm going to book my next trip because I can't bear the feeling of not being on a trip. And so I would say, be brave and have courage to sit in that discomfort, because it teaches you a lot. You know, that might be the moment that you have the most growth and you say, you know what, I really love that for these reasons, but it wasn't quite what I wanted because of these reasons. And I think have the courage to sit with that for at least a few weeks or whatever. And then you make your decision. There's no big rush. But I think the impulse to feel better often makes us do things that aren't always mistakes, but perhaps we wouldn't be doing from a calm state.
Again, you're welcome to, you know, shoot this down if you want to, although I'm pretty sure you won't. But I think, you know, I've been talking to a few people recently who are kind of my age and have been doing it for the same amount of time as me, and I get that motivations can really change over the course of our expedition careers. And somebody who's on the edge of doing that first expedition, you know, can't assume, but they'll probably be very excited about it all. And they will come back and it will have been the best thing they've ever done, almost certainly. And they'll be excited to do more. And, you know, I love going on expedition. It's one of my favorite things in the world. But I've realized now much more than 50% of why I go away is so that I can come home, if that makes any sense. I don't know if you have any views on why that might be or what it is about these places that makes coming home so special.
I think it's wonderful that you feel like that for the first thing. I do also. I mean, you know, although we said earlier it's difficult when people can't relate to your experience, there's nothing nicer than coming home and people have missed you. And, you know, those relationships are so important. It doesn't mean people have to be with you all the time, but yeah, it's the people you come home to. I don't at all think that's a problem. I think, as I said before, it's kind of a little bit linked to perhaps your identity. What are your motivations for going? And I think perhaps in one's early expedition career, there's a sense of wanting to, the external validation you get from doing something exciting or extraordinary. And I, again, quoting Brené Brown, who's one of my favorites, but we don't sort of honor the ordinary moments enough in life. And as she says, you know, in the dire parts of life when someone's dying or you're dying or whatever, it's the ordinary moments that you really want and you want to hold on to. So I think it's really important to celebrate both, to be like, yeah, I want to go off and climb this mountain, but I'm also really excited about coming home. And that's, for me, the ideal. And I think anyone who's worried about either of those, yeah, again, it's just a point to maybe think, well, what are my motivations for being away, and how do I see myself at home? How do I see that process of coming back? And all motivations hopefully should be coming from us, really. I mean, that's the ideal, isn't it? But it's difficult in the world we live in sometimes to not be influenced by others. And I think there is a growing need to be doing something higher, something further, something deeper, and that doesn't always align with actually what we want to do inside. And I think that's where the problems occur.
I think finally, there's, you know, I'm hyper aware that what we're talking about here is quite big and quite heavy and quite serious, but it is incredibly important. And I think I'd like to ask you, you know, given everything you know, everything you've studied, everything you've experienced, all of these big, heavy, serious topics, would you recommend people go on expedition, and why?
Wow. Yes, I would recommend it. I would I always say this to people who want to do expedition medicine. So I've got to the grand old age, apparently, where people now come and ask me, I'm like, what? For advice on what they should do. And it's very interesting, sometimes quite early on into the conversation, you ask people why they want to do it and they can't tell you. And that's a little bit of an alarm bell for me. You have to want to do the thing you're going to do for more reason than just because I think I should or because it looks good or whatever. So I think ask yourself the reasons you're doing it and make sure they align with what you really want. But also, you know, from my point of view, from the topic of this conversation, yes, people should go and do these things. I would like to see more of people going, doing these things in acknowledgement that they're hard mentally as well as physically, but that great things mentally can come from it if we look after ourselves. But we do have to look after ourselves to do that. And pretending that you don't get affected by these things, I think, isn't the way forward for that. So go and do it, but do it safely in the way that, I mean, physical safety has become so much more talked about than, you know, back in the day when people were sailing off not knowing when they would come back. Now let's do the same for all parts of ourselves. And then, yeah, my answer would be let's make expeditions more accessible to more people. You know, let's get everyone experiencing sitting by the campfire in the woods. But as you said before, that doesn't have to be anything grand. It can be in your back garden. It's that mentality of freedom, of connection to the outdoors, of connection to people, conversations, expedition mentality.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more information on how to get started with planning your own expedition or field research project, head to rgs.org. This podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, produced and edited by Laura Jaycock for Terra Incognita Publishing, and Shane Windsor and Laura Melville for the Royal Geographical Society.